Chapter 47. Gary's Big Change. Everything felt completely out of place for Gary as he reported for duty on the DEA strike force he'd been assigned to in New York City. Unlike the IRS's beige downtown office building, which was surrounded by a blockade of federal monoliths and local courthouses, his new workplace was above 14th Street, nestled in among hipster bodegas, cupcake shops, and the Chelsea Elliott housing projects. At the IRS, every cubicle was as tall as a man, which afforded privacy for agents and their spreadsheets. Yet the cubicles in his new office were low and open. As a result, when Gary sat down at his desk, no matter which direction he looked, he found himself gazing directly into someone else's eyes. This was all intentional, Gary was told, designed to get people from different government agencies, NYPD, DEA, IRS, and local and state police, on the task force talking to one another about their cases. He had no privacy. People in his new office dressed differently too, wearing casual street clothes, like sneakers and t-shirts. Gary didn't own any of these, so he had to go shopping with his wife to buy boots and jeans, which made him feel like he was wearing someone else's clothes. Buttoned-up Gary felt completely out of place. The most dissimilar aspect of the new task force was the open-door policy. People shared the information they had gleaned from their investigations with everyone else. It was all for one, not a cadre of solo IRS suits counting pennies alone. Before arriving, Gary had done his homework, scouring news articles, forum posts by the Dread Pirate Roberts, and research about the dark web, all to get acquainted with the case he was about to join. While reading these pieces, Gary had come across the first white paper that had been published about Bitcoin, written by the creator of the digital currency, an anonymous man who went by the pseudonym Satoshi Nakamoto. Gary read the paper once and nothing stood out. He read it a second time and still nothing. But the third time he noticed something in a section of the paper that referenced the gambler's ruin problem, a theory that no matter how much money you have in a betting scenario, the casino, or house, has an infinite amount of money, and therefore if you keep making bets, the house will eventually win. Gary reasoned that the same theory was true for DPR and the Silk Road. The U.S. government was the casino. DPR was the gambler. Eventually, Gary believed, because the Dread Pirate Roberts wouldn't stop playing, he would lose. To say that Gary was excited about this case was the understatement of his career. He was ecstatic. As soon as he was settled into his office, or as close to settled as he could be, he was briefed by his new teammates. This was when he very quickly learned that everyone else was not as enthusiastic about the Silk Road case as Gary was. At least, not anymore. Investigators were burned out and fed up, given that their probe had gone nowhere. To them, Gary arriving with all of this enthusiasm for the case was like a child waking up in mid-August, thinking that it was Christmas morning. His co-case agents immediately noticed something about Gary, too. When he spoke, he would often interrupt himself and utter a rhetorical, "you know," or "right," almost like someone saying the words "rye" and "tight" together very quickly. He did this all the time. Gary could be chatting away at full stride, and in mid-sentence, he would reach into the depths of his core and, as if he were trying to impersonate a bear, bellow the word, "right," followed by, "you know, you know?" And then he would just keep going, as if nothing had happened. Still, "you know" and "right" aside, the task force agents explained where the investigation stood. It was May 2013, exactly 2 years since the famed Gawker article had been published, and there were dozens of government agents and task forces all over the world trying to figure out how to breach the Silk Road. There was a team in Baltimore, Carl, a lone agent in Chicago, Jared, and more than a dozen others scattered around the globe, all trying to figure out the identity of the dread pirate Roberts. But the case so far had proved unsolvable. Midway through his briefing, Gary was informed that since nothing else had worked, the task force wanted to try a new strategy. They instructed Gary to follow the money rather than the drugs. One of the places they wanted him to start with was a user on the Silk Road who'd been buying and selling bitcoins for drug dealers and the site's creators, acting as a digital money launderette. The strike force told Gary to try to figure out who this human bitcoin-to-cash ATM was. Then they could try to trace some of those bitcoins. Gary was completely up for the task of finding the money launderer, but he also had an idea how they might be able to find the dread pirate Roberts. "How?" one of the cops dubiously asked. "The son of Sam," Gary replied. Gary had heard stories about the New York City serial killer known as the Son of Sam so many times as a kid that it was impossible to forget. But what had always stuck out to him, he explained to the agent, was the way authorities caught the murderer. It had all taken place between 1976 and 1977, in the same neighborhood where Gary was raised. At the time, the Son of Sam had gone on a killing spree in New York, terrorizing the city and making fools of the NYPD. No matter how many police officers and detectives City Hall threw at the investigation, it was unsolvable. A task force that was set up to find the murderer went nowhere. Yet shortly after the blackout of 1977, one police officer decided to try a new and creative angle to find the killer. Rather than search the crime scene looking for weapons or clues, the officer decided to look for cars in the areas of the murders that had received parking tickets around the same times as the crimes. The cop reasoned that even the most brazen murderer wouldn't have stopped midway through to go and feed a parking meter. So maybe the Son of Sam had gotten one or two parking tickets during his attacks. After a painstaking search through tens of thousands of violations, the cops found a pattern. There was a 1970 yellow Ford Galaxy sedan that belonged to a man who lived in Yonkers and had been ticketed numerous times within blocks of each of the murders. When detectives went to the car owner's home, they were greeted by David Berkowitz, a defiant 24-year-old who admitted instantly that he was the Son of Sam. "Well, you've got me," Berkowitz said at the time, and then, with one last barb toward police, "What took you so long?" Gary told his new team that the similarities abounded. In 1977, traditional policing techniques had failed to solve the murders in the same way that in 2013, modern-day procedures for capturing drug dealers had failed to catch DPR. Both men taunted the police. Both men grew more brazen as they continued to get away with their crimes. And the task forces then and now had failed to find them both. "I'm going to crack this case," Gary told anyone who would listen. "I really think I'm going to get DPR." Just like the parking citations had helped catch the Son of Sam during the summer of 1977, Gary was convinced that somewhere out there, the founder of the Silk Road had made a mistake. He believed that in a dark corner of the internet, there was the digital equivalent of a parking ticket that would help unmask the dread pirate Roberts. And Gary Alford was determined that he was going to find it.